Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Considering what you got impacted, I think the city looks pretty good. Unfortunately, there's probably millions of dollars of damage going outside the city.
Officials in Nome take stock of the storm damage outside city limits. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 20th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, researchers monitoring a landslide in Prince William Sound say the slope is moving faster.
We don't know exactly what it means, but it is the opposite of reassuring.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
Assessments, cleanup, and rebuilding continue in western Alaska after the remnants of Typhoon Murbach hit about 1,000 miles of coastline over the weekend. At a press conference in Bethel last night, Governor Mike Dunleavy said he will request a federal disaster declaration for the storm. The declaration would make federal funding and support available for recovery efforts. Major General Torrence Sachs is commissioner of the Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. He said before the governor can submit the request, state officials must determine how much funding to ask for. Sachs said the state will ask the federal government for both public and private assistance.
So that would be money for infrastructure and also for individual homes. And to get that, we need to get boots on the ground from FEMA, which they are doing right now, to assess exactly what has happened and the dollar amount.
Dunleavy said if the federal disaster declaration is approved, FEMA would cover at least 75% of eligible disaster costs.
Well, we think that a lot of the damage is going to be as a result of erosion on roads, some structures, maybe some power poles, et cetera. So we believe that that's fitting for the federal government to help with that.
Yesterday, state officials visited Hooper Bay and Scammon Bay and flew over Chivac. Dunleavy said there was less damage than some officials had anticipated, and things were starting to go back to normal. Brian Fisher is the director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management for the state. On Talk of Alaska today, he said the state will fund initial repairs while they wait for the federal money.
The good news is that many communities are looking really good. All of the airports are up and running. Bypass mail and mail is going to be delivered. Important this week with the permanent fund checks starting to go out. We're able to get in and provide that food, water, and services to support folks that are still being sheltered that can't get back into their homes yet.
Fisher said 63 Western Alaska homes have reported damage so far. State officials are set to visit Nome tomorrow. And the city of Nome's focus is on infrastructure as cleanup crews move toward the east end of town and assess damage in the areas outside city limits. KNOM's Davis Hovey reports.
Aside from a transformer that blew yesterday at the state office building on Front Street, Nome's downtown area is in good shape. That was City Manager Glenn Steckman's assessment during a recent emergency operations meeting.
Considering what you got impacted, I think the city looks pretty good. And unfortunately, there's probably millions of dollars of damage going outside the city.
After significant cleanup efforts from many local volunteers, a storm recovery version of Nome is what some visiting tourists saw yesterday. Port Director Joy Baker says the next scheduled cruise ship, La Boreal, was able to stop into town for the day. Baker recommended the city have an inspector from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers take a look at the bridge at the causeway and other port infrastructure. The lingering question was about the condition of the port's fuel lines, which Baker says has now been addressed.
We've done an air test on the lines and the pressure held on all three lines last night. So we are calling it, and we talked to Seekers, and he agreed that the pressure stayed good all night, that we can use the lines. And after the utility fuels in the line, we're going to go ahead and hydro test that one.
Looking outside city limits, the dock area around Cape Nome and surrounding landscape is completely changed. Alaska Sea Grant biologist Gay Sheffield says she was taking water samples and assisting stranded marine mammals in the Cape Nome area, which is unrecognizable.
The rocks from the south end are now filling in and have been moved so that it's all rocks filled into the north side of the pier. You can't sample there anymore because there's no water there. It's just filled with boulders.
East of town, the city of Nome is still assessing the full extent of the damage at places like Fort Davis, to the cabins and subsistence areas that are vital to Nome residents, and to the Safety Sound Bridge near Mile 22. But Calvin Schaefer, the Western District Regional Manager for DOT, confirms there is a new channel flowing between the Bering Sea and Safety Sound.
Looking at putting a dozer down at 16 Mile right now to start finding a road in there and get through to safety to the bridge and assess what we're going to do on that side of it with the big washout, the new channel that's its way in there.
It is currently unclear how many native allotments and subsistence camps were affected at this point. However, Schaefer says several cabins were moved across the lagoon by the rising water and are now standing in new locations. Governor Mike Dunleavy is planning to visit Nome tomorrow to see the damage for himself. Reporting in Nome, I'm Davis Hovey.
The northwest Arctic city of Kotzebue was spared major damage from ex-Typhoon Murbach over the weekend. City manager Tom Atkinson says there was some flooding in homes along the southern edge of town and the small boat harbor on Saturday. By Sunday afternoon, he says water was already draining back out to sea.
And given that Kotzebue is 7 feet above sea level, things were kind of tight in terms of, you know, the water being up high enough to actually come up and cover most of Kotzebue. But fortunately, we never got to that point.
Atkinson says the impact to homes was minimal since most houses are built on posts above the ground. Kotzebue is about 200 miles north of Nome on the other side of the Seward Peninsula. Climatologists say the typhoon had weakened significantly by the time it passed through the Bering Strait, which is why communities along the Chukchi Sea saw much less damage than those farther south like Nome and Hooper Bay. The storm surge never crested the seawall built on the north edge of Kotzebue in 2012 to help protect the town from coastal erosion. Atkinson says the storm did cause erosion damage in some parts of town exposed to Kotzebue Sound, including two bridges. The short-term solution is to replace the ground that was washed away, hopefully before freeze-up sets in a few weeks. In the long term, Atkinson says the city is pursuing more permanent solutions like extending the seawall and installing a storm drain system for the city.
I think the storm made it obvious to us that, you know, if these type of events keep happening, which we all know they probably will, that we have to continue to find ways to keep water out of town.
Some flooding was reported over the weekend in the nearby villages of Kivalina and Deering, but with no major impacts, according to the Northwest Arctic Bureau. Alaska's congressional delegation sent a letter today to the Interior Secretary asking her to approve the Willow Project, a proposed oil development in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. It's not the first such letter Alaska's U.S. senators have sent, but this time Congresswoman Mary Peltola has signed it too. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin explains the significance.
The letter recounts the lengthy permitting process. It lists benefits to Alaska's economy, and it urges Interior Secretary Deb Haaland to approve the project in time for the winter construction season. Republican Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan have sent at least two prior letters, but Peltola's signature might be more meaningful to Haaland. She, like Peltola, is one of only a handful of Indigenous women to ever serve in Congress. Haaland gave an emotional speech at a reception last week celebrating Peltola's swearing in, and they're both Democrats. Whatever the letter may do to help the Willow Project overcome the objections of environmental groups, it surely helps Peltola's image as she campaigns in a Republican-leaning state. She'll be on the ballot again in less than 2 months. Actions like this help her show that she can work in tandem with Alaska's Republican senators. They also demonstrate that she's for some development projects and make it harder for her Republican opponents, Sarah Palin and Nick Begich, to define her as a captive of the Democratic left. Reporting from Washington, D.C., I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, how a constitutional convention could affect abortion rights in Alaska.
What could be more private and more personal than the right to decide what to do with your own body?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
Researchers monitoring the landslide at Berry Arm in Prince William Sound say recent movement there is significant in its speed and scope, but they say they're no closer to knowing when a catastrophic slide might occur that could trigger a potentially life-threatening tsunami near Whittier. Even without that information, Saldovia geologist Brettwood Higman says the update should be taken seriously.
We don't know exactly what it means, but it is the opposite of reassuring.
Berry Arm has been under the proverbial microscope since 2020, when scientists first took note of movement at the unstable fjord northeast of Whittier. The slope could fall into the water below, creating a wave that could pose a serious risk to boaters and recreators in the vicinity, and, in a worst-case scenario, a wave up to 7 feet high in Whittier. According to a status update Friday from the State Department of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, the slope is moving faster than it has since 2020 when monitoring began. Higman says that kind of acceleration is something that can happen to slopes before they fail.
And this, in the last, month and a half here, there have been these accelerations of particularly one portion of that mass. So that could be a sign of impending failure.
The portion of the landslide that is moving is right above the water at Berry Arm. In response to the acceleration, the state says scientists have stopped accessing the site by water. Unfortunately, the new data does not tell researchers when a failure might occur.
That makes it really a difficult message, because we don't want to be in the position where we see something scary, but we don't say anything because we don't know how scary it is. But we also don't want to say, like, well, we saw something and we're all terrified and nobody should go there, because we don't really know if it's that bad.
Still, he says it's important for the public to know about the change.
For individuals who are making choices about whether to spend time and what sorts of activities to do in that area, I would say this should be received as a note of caution.
While scientists are watching the slide at Berry Arm closely, it's not the only unstable slope in the area. In much of coastal Alaska, glacial retreat has left slopes exposed, unstable, and more prone to failure. Higman says he's monitoring hundreds of others, including the Ellsworth Glacier near Moose Pass. Just last week, there was a landslide there, sending 10 million tons of material sliding. The material did not hit the water, and Higman says even if it had, it's remote enough that it wouldn't have had any human impact. The constitutional convention question is coming up on the November ballot. That's Alaskans' once-a-decade opportunity to decide whether to open up the state constitution for revisions. Anti-abortion advocates and proponents of a constitutional convention have their eyes on one section of the document in particular, the Privacy Clause, which is the basis for reproductive rights in Alaska. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George explains what the Privacy Clause is and what could happen to abortion rights if a convention takes place.
The Privacy Clause of the Alaska State Constitution dates back to the early 1970s. Around that time, concerns about the evolving information age, the use of computers, and the security of individuals' private information were taking root. In 1972, the Alaska legislature drafted a constitutional amendment that explicitly guarantees the right to privacy, and voters overwhelmingly approved it. Over the years, legal decisions have defined what the right to privacy includes in Alaska.
The right to privacy is a steadily evolving one.
That's former Alaska Attorney General Bruce Botello. Broadly, the privacy clause protects the right to shield personal information as well as the right to personal autonomy.
It's decided in part by cases that are real controversies, and those controversies illuminate what the contours of that right to privacy is.
And it's led to some important changes in Alaska law. It supports marijuana possession rights in our state, and it's also the basis for Alaskans' reproductive rights. Abortion has been a legal medical procedure in Alaska since 1970, before Roe v. Wade. But the law included a provision that no hospital or person was required to participate in providing an abortion. In 1997, that was challenged when a group of pro-choice advocates sued a hospital in Palmer that had banned abortions. The case reached the Alaska Supreme Court, where justices ruled that the Constitution's privacy clause protects individuals' rights to abortion.
I mean, there's some great language in the case about what could be more private and more personal than the right to decide what to do with your own body.
That's Susan Orlansky, cooperative counsel for the Alaska ACLU. Orlansky says in the years since the Palmer Hospital decision, other rulings have referenced the privacy clause to enumerate the scope of abortion rights. For example, in 2019, the Alaska Supreme Court rejected laws that restricted access to abortion for people on Medicaid. About a dozen U.S. states have similar privacy clauses in their state constitutions, and a few, including Florida, Montana, and Minnesota, view abortion as legal under the right to privacy. If a constitutional convention happens in Alaska, Orlansky says there are a number of ways an abortion ban might be written into the law.
You could rewrite the privacy clause exactly the way it is now with a comma, except that this doesn't apply to abortion. Or you could write in Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution, this Constitution applies to everyone, and by everyone we include life from the moment of conception. That would be a really easy way to do it.
In any case, delegates would have to approve the new language, and then Alaska voters would need to vote to accept the revised Constitution after the convention. Botello says that might not be easy to achieve.
The bar is high, and to be honest, not simply with this issue, but I think, let's say, generally, one should want a high bar before changing the fundamental law of the state.
In a state that has historically supported access to abortion, Botello says any constitutional abortion bans would likely be difficult to pass. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline since 1977, from Prudhoe Bay to the Port of Valdez.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
The Alaska Department of Health has expanded eligibility for the monkeypox vaccine. The department announced this week that anyone who believes they are at an increased risk for infection is now eligible. According to the State Health Department, that might include sex workers, certain healthcare workers, and people with intimate or household contact with gay or bisexual men, and transgender people with multiple partners. Those interested in getting vaccinated can contact their local public health center or call the state's helpline. More than 450 doses have been administered in the state as of today. Five cases have been reported in Alaska, four of which were in Anchorage. State transportation officials have taken a small step toward building a new ferry terminal at the end of Juneau's road. It's intended to shorten travel times and improve service between Juneau, Haines, Skagway, and the road system. KTOO's Jeremy Shea reports.
Federal officials approved a wide-ranging amendment earlier this month to the Statewide Transportation Infrastructure Program, or STIP. Among the dozens of new projects in the list is a call for $30 million for the new ferry terminal, but on no specific timeline. Projects that make the list aren't guaranteed federal funding, but it is one avenue that can lead to it. A Federal Highway Administration spokesperson says that the Cascade Point project is only illustrative at this point and is not yet eligible for funding. Goldbelt Incorporated, Juneau's urban native corporation, owns the undeveloped land at Cascade Point. By sea, it's about 23 miles closer to Haines and Skagway than Juneau's existing ferry terminal at Auk Bay. Goldbelt and the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities signed an agreement in 2021 to work together on the new ferry terminal idea.
We've been working together to try to come to an agreement to develop that area. We're still in a process of establishing feasibility, trying to establish that funding mechanism and who's doing what.
Rob Carpenter is the state's Deputy Transportation Commissioner.
In this particular case, we have a potential vision of a long-term lease with Cascade Point where the Goldbelt Corporation would build it and we would lease it to them in some kind of long-term period.
The shorter ferry route is expected to reduce the system's operating expenses, slash fares, and shorten travel time. That's even after factoring in the extra driving time. It also means crew could complete a full circuit between Juneau, Skagway, and Haines without running afoul of a Coast Guard rule that limits work shifts to 12 hours. The concept for the new ferry terminal is Spartan and would not replace the terminal at Auk Bay. It calls for an unstaffed day-use facility with off-the-grid support infrastructure, pit toilets, storage tanks for drinking water and to take sewage from ferries, and an electricity generator on site. Goldbelt CEO McHugh Pierre says improving this link will have wider ripple effects on the average shareholder and Juneau as a whole.
That we could have lower cost of transportation, which would provide lower cost of goods, which would then lead to lower cost of services and lower cost of living in Juneau, not to mention fresher produce, you know, better products, and just overall better quality of life.
Additional facilities at the site could improve Goldbelt's shuttle service for Kensington mine workers. The new ferry terminal concept has its skeptics and critics. Aaron Brakel is with the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, which prizes the surrounding Berners Bay for its wildlife and pristine beauty.
You know, Cascade Point is a terrible project for Juneau. It's bad for Haines, it's bad for Skagway.
He says it will be a logistical nightmare getting people to and from the end of the road, though Goldbelt says it will offer bus service. Brakel says additional marine traffic in the area could also threaten herring runs in Berners Bay. However, Brakel says he's very supportive of the ferry system's interest in building an electric ferry. Earlier this year, the state applied for a federal grant seeking $46 million to build one that would work for short routes, specifically running between Haines and Skagway, Homer and Seldovia, or Ketchikan and Metlakatla. Brakel says if an electric ferry regularly ran between Haines and Skagway, then a ferry from Juneau wouldn't need to go to both communities in one day.
And it would really solve this Juneau to Northland Canal day run issue in a much better way. Auk Bay to Haines, perfect. You know, no other turnaround needed. That's a really good solution in my view.
Even if the ferry terminal doesn't happen, Cascade Point and other land around Echo Cove are flagged in Juneau's long-term land use plan for development eventually, with a mix of residential, recreational, and water-related uses. Historically, Juneau's local officials have supported development efforts there. In 1998, the Juneau Assembly supported extending the road to Cascade Point. And in 2013, the mayor attended a ribbon cutting for the new section of road. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Ketchikan Public Library supporters gathered Saturday for what organizers called a read-in. They were opposing a ballot measure that would strip borough funding from the library. As KRBD's Eric Stone reports, people waved signs, handed out books, and urged voters to support the library this October.
I support it because it's a good, because I want people to learn what they can read and question and think. So I support it because I like it.
8-year-old Aurora Hopps stands on the side of North Tongass Highway with a handwritten sign saying, "I love the library. It is for everyone." Her sister, 7-year-old Anaya Hopps, has a sign that says, "We love our library."
We get to read, and sometimes we like to get CDs and headphone sets, and while we're cleaning up our house, we get to listen to them. And the books are really nice.
Their mom, Nina Hopps, says the library is a central part of her family's life. She homeschools the kids, and she says Aurora and Naya check out over 100 books a month.
And the library has really been foundational to our family because they had the baby story time, they have all the activities and ways to meet other families and kids to be friends for life, basically. So the Ketchikan Library is part of our family.
The family is out here at Wolf Point spending this sunny Saturday waving signs because they're concerned about Proposition 2. It's a ballot measure that would remove the borough's authority to collect a property tax on homes and businesses outside city limits. That tax provides nearly 40% of the Ketchikan Public Library's annual funding, or what equals about $500,000. The ballot measure was proposed this summer after the library hosted a story time with a drag queen. If the measure passes, Ketchikan's library director says she would have to make drastic cuts to services. She'd have to lay off about half of the library's employees and cut its hours by 25%. The roughly 2,000 library cardholders who live outside city limits would not be able to check out materials. And almost all programming for children, teens, adults, and elders would have to be cut. Nina Hopps says it would be a devastating loss.
So to lose the resource of the library would mean that we would lose hundreds of books that we would read each year, that my kids memorize and remember and become part of them. So losing that amount of books, resources, and activities would be a huge impact.
A little further down the street is Catlin Jacobson. She's the librarian for Ketchikan High School. She says a funding cut for the public library would have a ripple effect on the school system's libraries.
Our schools are looking at drastic cuts if this were to go through. They check out, we borrow from the public library over 1,400 items a year. That equates almost $30,000 worth of books that we borrow from the public library, just our students, district-wide. So that's a huge benefit to our students that would be gone.
And she says that would have a ripple effect on literacy for children all over Ketchikan.
All studies show that the more books a child has, whether it's at home or in the classroom, is going to make them a better reader and make them enjoy reading more. Especially, most importantly, freedom of choice. That's what makes kids excited about reading. If they find that Garfield comic book that they want to read, they're going to want to pick it up and keep reading. So that's really the essential role that libraries play in helping kids read.
Part of what's driving the ballot proposition is the idea that residents outside city limits don't have enough say in what goes on at the library. Only the Ketchikan City Council, rather than the Borough Assembly, has the authority to set the library's budget and review programming decisions. Nina Hopps, the homeschooling mom, says there are plenty of ways, though, that residents can have their voices heard.
I'm on the advisory board, and we've had meetings where nobody shows up. So if you want an in and you want someone to listen, we are there to listen, and we're there for open opinions and suggestions. And since nobody's showing up, it's showing me that they're maybe only care about money.
Proposition 2 goes to Ketchikan Gateway Borough voters outside city limits on October 4th. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
Well, that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts, which now includes Spotify. We had reports tonight from Davis Hovey in Nome, Kavitha George in Kotzebue, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Jeremy Shea in Juneau, and Eric Stone in Ketchikan. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Dave Emmert. Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.